Robots Radio presents...
In 1939, director Frank Capra and star Jimmy Stewart filibustered the nation with a gripping drama that vilified government corruption.
In 2019, Diageo gives us one of America's most favorite bourbons.
The film is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
The whiskey is Bullet Bourbon.
And we'll review them both. This is...
The Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
And we're about to get political.
Hey-oh.
I'm Brad G.
And this week we are looking at the 1939 classic, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Now, Brad, this is actually a really special month in film and whiskey history because we're going to be looking at four films from 1939. 1939 is regarded widely as the greatest year in movie history. So in honor of that great movie year, we are calling this month...
The Golden Month.
The Golden Month. And we're kicking it off today with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And we will have three more, The Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, and Gone with the Wind coming up in the next few weeks. Brad, have you ever seen any movies from 1939?
I have seen Stagecoach, and I have seen The Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
So dang,
you're batting 500 here. Yeah, that's not bad at all, sir. Well, we know, Brad, that you have not seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So I'm really excited to get into this episode and hear about your thoughts on this movie. You know, this is one of those films that I don't feel like a lot of people nowadays have seen, even though I can see this being shown even still in like a high school government class or something like that, right alongside with Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about that is I feel like a lot of people will talk about like To Kill a Mockingbird or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or I don't know. There's other like famous movies where they're like, oh, yeah, I watched that back in high school. I don't know if my high school is just different. I don't ever remember watching any movies in high school.
Oh,
for like
man.
Any class.
Maybe your high school was like the movie equivalent of that town in Footloose where they just can't dance and your high school was just like no movies for anyone.
You know, I do think I remember watching Osmosis Jones in biology.
Oh my gosh. So Osmosis Jones was cool, but Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Verboten. All right, Brad, well, why don't we get into talking about this movie? And I think the best way for us to begin our conversation is to do our favorite segment, which is called Brad Explains.
Brad Explains.
Brad, can you explain for us the plot of the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
And if anything, I should emulate the famous Jefferson Smith by taking so long to explain the plot that I just filibuster us all the way through the rest of the episode. Does
hey,
that
man,
sound good to you, Bob?
I'm good with it. I'm just going to sit back and drink whiskey.
I will not yield the floor to you, Senator Book. So, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is a classic film. It is a movie about a young man named Jefferson Smith. So, Mr. Smith is from some unnamed state. I would imagine out west, the way he talks about it, like vast, you know, tracts of land and stuff. So, long story short, the senator from his state dies, you know, one of the two senators, and until they can have an election to elect a new senator, the governor has to appoint an honorary senator to stand in for a while, and he has pressure from a newspaper magnate named James Taylor to appoint his very own hand-picked senator who will just pass through all the bills that he wants him to pass through, but then there's a reformer party that is putting pressure on him to put a reformer into the office. So the governor decides to flip a coin and decide whether he picks the reformer or the stooge that will just pass through all the stuff the rich guy wants. However, before he does this, his children try to convince him that this random guy named Jefferson Smith, who's a Boy Scout leader or a ranger, or they call it something, and they're like, hey, Dad, you should pick this guy. He's really cool and fights fires and can quote, you know, Abe Lincoln and Washington and stuff. So he flips the coin, and lo and behold, it falls against the newspaper, neither heads nor tails. And on the newspaper is an article about who other than Jefferson Smith. So he sends Jefferson Smith on to Washington, who's very naive and not wise to the ways of the world. Jefferson tries to get this bill passed that will create a national park for young boys to go spend the summer in. And the park is going to be located at the same location where a dam is being built that the other senator from his state, Senator Payne, is having built. But unfortunately, this dam that's being built is full of graft and corruption, and it's really bad news bears for the state. Jimmy Stewart finds this out, and so he tries to reveal this to the Senate, but before he can do that, he yields the floor to his fellow senator, who he's looked up to, but is actually corrupt, and that senator accuses him of trying to build this boy's state park for his own profit. And so they go into an inquiry and this hearing, and he gets crucified in front of the media and in front of the Senate. And so the next day, they're trying to talk about expelling him from the Senate, and Jimmy Stewart gains control of the Senate and begins a filibuster trying to convince people that he is not corrupt and that this dam that they're trying to build is corrupt. And so he filibusters for 24 straight hours without sitting. And the newspaper guy, James Taylor, is like trying to shut it down and not allow any news of it to reach the state. And James Stewart passes out and they carry him out like Christ. And the corrupt senator announces that he's corrupt and he has victory. And Jim Stewart wins for the common man.
And that's it. That's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, Bob, that was a really hard one to do because it's a very intricate movie. And it's kind of difficult to explain.
Yeah, that was definitely a much more involved Brad Explains than normal. But I think we had to do it that way just to talk about the things that are going on in this movie. And one of the things that I love about the film, Brad, is that Frank Capra, the director, and the screenwriters of this film do such a good job at not bogging you down in information. You get just as much as you need. You find out that there's corruption. You find out that James Taylor and Senator Payne are in cahoots together and they're going to get some sort of kickback. There's graft going on. And Jimmy Stewart finds out what he needs to know and he goes on the offensive against it. And then eventually he has to defend himself. But you find out all of this sort of intricate knowledge about how the Senate operates and the sort of parliamentary procedure of the Senate and things you typically wouldn't care to know, but they make it not just interesting, but actively suspenseful and exciting to learn about how Jimmy Stewart is going to dig himself out of this hole.
Bob, can I be honest with you for a second?
Yeah.
I cried during this movie.
Oh, I did too, at multiple points.
This movie, for being about parliamentary procedure, is an absolutely gripping drama that just sucks you in. And it doesn't necessarily right away, but within like 30 minutes of the movie, you're completely drawn into this young man's plight. And it absolutely takes you to the places emotionally that you need to go. I can't believe how good of a movie this is.
Yeah, it's a great movie. But I don't think that it's a perfect movie. And I think this is going to be my big struggle throughout the episode, Brad, is that this is probably one of my personal favorite movies. This movie takes me to an emotional place every time. And yet, there's things about this movie that I can't help but kind of view a little more critically. Now that we've been watching all these movies and we've been nitpicking all of them, my favorites are not exempt from getting that treatment. And so I think I'm going to have to go back and forth on like praising this movie and nitpicking this movie because I just don't know how else to do it.
Well, I would like to do this. How about we start with a lot of our nitpicks and then we kind of move to the things we love about the movie? Does that sound decent?
That sounds good to me. And I will say up front at this point in the podcast, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast for any length of time, you know, and if you've made it to this point, you know within this episode that we are a spoiler-filled podcast. A lot of the movies that we are watching are 70, 80 years old, so you've had time to catch up with them. But in order to talk about the movie in depth, we've always felt like we need to be able to talk about everything that happens in the movie. So if you haven't seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, even with the explanation that Brad gave, I think it's a good idea for you to watch the movie and then come back and engage with the ideas after the fact, because it really is worth watching.
Yeah, out of all the movies that we've reviewed thus far, I genuinely would say that this is probably the movie the average citizen of America needs to watch.
All right, Brad, so why don't you kick us off then? We'll talk about nitpicks for a little while, and then we'll get into heaping praise on this movie.
From the very start of this movie, you know, the opening scene is of the governor, and he finds out that this senator had died, and he's freaking out about it, and everybody's all upset. And from the very start of this movie, I literally had this thought right away. I was like, wow, this is a very ham-fisted movie. Like, they are not going to let the audience think anything other than what they want you to think. I mean, they just shove it down your throat. Who is good? Who is bad? Who is corrupt? Who is pure? And like from the very start, there are no questions that could be asked about good and evil in this film. You know it all right up front.
Yeah, there's no subtlety to any of it. I mean, you know, Frank Capra also directed It's a Wonderful Life, which is a movie that we will get to eventually. And It's a Wonderful Life is not a subtle movie. And yet, when I compare the two, it's almost like It's a Wonderful Life is this brilliant, mature work of subtlety compared to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Everyone is so black and white, and almost all of the performances, except for the leads, are so over the top that it's almost comical. And it makes you wonder how these characters played in 1939. Like, I know a lot of this was done for laughs. I know it's intentional. But did the movie come across as cheesy to an audience in 1939? Because I don't think there's any denying that there are portions of this movie that are just undeniably cheesy.
For sure. And I think that Capra chose to do that so that he could highlight the nuances of Jimmy Stewart's performance. And I will say that the stark contrast between what feels like poor acting from the other characters in the movie outside of the performance of Gene Arthur, you really see that these other characters are so black and white, and they're so obvious about the words that they say and how they deliver them and the motivations that they have, that you really get to, you see a focus kind of, you know, hone in on Jimmy Stewart, and you really get to see him perform, and his performance almost seems better because of how obvious the performances around him are.
Can I go back for a second to, you were talking about the very beginning, the opening of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And on this watch, it kind of struck me that Frank Capra does a really bad job with the rhythm of the movie right off the bat. Like, I felt like there was some sort of weird pacing issue, because the first couple scenes of the movie are such an exposition dump. Like, there's so much information being dumped on you by people who you don't know yet that it almost seems like you walked into this movie 15 minutes after it actually started, and you're getting so much plot up front. And I really struggled with those first few scenes because it was hard for me to get into the movie. Did you have that problem, Brad?
Oh, for sure. Like, I'm thinking of one specific scene where the governor of the unnamed state, you know, is talking on the phone, and he calls James Taylor, and he finishes the conversation, and it literally spends zero time with him after the conversation. The screen literally like blurs to the left and you're on to the next scene. And in that next scene, you come in the middle of somebody talking. And like, it's just so fast paced and they're throwing everything at you. And I will say that if I wanted to defend Capra in that moment, I might say something to the effect of he used that fast pacing in order to kind of highlight that the people who talk fast, the people who think fast, the people who can't wait a second without, you know, taking an action to fix the problems at hand, those are the evil ones. Because when you watch Jimmy Stewart act, he thinks about his decisions. He thinks about the words he's going to say. And so by using the pacing in that way, I think Capra is showing you that it's the people who never take a second to think before they act. Those are the evil ones. And Jimmy Stewart is the good one because he actually thinks about what he's going to say.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Brad. And I love that we're already kind of defending our nitpicks because I can tell that we both really love this movie. But before we get into heaping praise on things, Brad, do you have any other big nitpicks that you want to talk about?
Well, you see, there's a big problem here when you got everybody talking like this. See, everybody doesn't really sound like that, you see. I'm sorry, Bob, but when like every single other character than Jimmy Stewart is talking like they're from New York and half of them are supposed to be from this unnamed Western state, I just struggle with the, you know, characterizing of every single other character
than Jimmy Stewart. And I'm not going to lie, that annoyed me.
Yeah, and then you've got Claude Rains, who can't get his British accent under control at all.
Oh, for sure. And then you have the... They kept calling him president, but the vice president is the... in control of the Senate, correct?
Right. He presides over the Senate, so he's technically the president of the Senate.
Oh, okay. See, you learned something new.
That's right.
So, like, every time they say Mr. President, they kind of put the camera on him, and, like, half of the time, the vice president smiles, and it... I mean, I'm glad that we're releasing this episode somewhat near Halloween, because that is one of the creepiest smiles I have ever seen.
Oh, come
in
on,
my
man.
Life. Oh, Bob.
I really like the vice president because he's so clearly like a little bit of warmth in that cold, cold, sterile room.
Bob, I 100% agree with you. I really enjoyed the fact that he gave, you know, Jefferson Smith the time of day, but his smile is real creepy, bro.
So it's just literally the look of his face that you don't like.
No. His face is fine. It's when he barely opens his mouth just to barely reveal the top layer of his top row of teeth. Uh-huh. That's super weird, man.
All right. Duly noted. So, wow, we are really nitpicking this thing today.
Put up an Instagram poll where you have a picture. You need to do a screen grab of him smiling and ask people if it's the creepiest smile you've ever seen.
All right. We'll do. All right. My last big nitpick for the movie. Well, actually, it's not my last one.
I just threw you, didn't I?
You did. That was such a minute detail to get worked up about.
It bothered the heck out of me every time he smiled.
All right, my next nitpick is about the scene where Diz and Saunders get rip-roaring drunk and decide to get married. And they turn that into like a 10-12 minute sequence where they're just in the bar and then they go back to the office and they come across Jimmy Stewart. I just thought that whole sequence was way too long, and I understood what they were trying to do. You know, they're filling in Diz's character a little bit. You can tell he really loves Saunders. They're filling in Saunders a little bit because you can see that she really cares about Jimmy Stewart, doesn't want to be, you know, she keeps saying, I won't be party to no murder, see? I understand that they're trying to flesh out those characters, but they literally took 10-12 minutes of screen time to advance the plot just that little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That was a really interesting scene that could have been about 3 minutes long. And you're right. It just kept going on and on. They kept playing up this thing where they were going to get married, but they hadn't spent enough time together for you to realize that they were like good friends. So it felt really weird and out of place. And so, yeah, I would agree that that scene just kind of felt meh to me.
All right, this is good. I think that I have aired most of my grievances with this movie. Brad, are you feeling better?
Yeah, I'd also like to talk about Diz for a second.
All right, let's talk about him. You know, he's played by the famous character actor Thomas Mitchell, who we will also see just in a couple weeks here as Scarlett O'Hara's dad in Gone with the Wind. He is one of the most revered character actors of all time, and this movie has some great character actors in it. Brad, what did you think about Thomas Mitchell?
Well, I guess you already kind of stole my thunder. I was going to comment on the fact that he is in 3 out of the 4 movies we're going to review this month.
Oh, that's true. He's in Stagecoach, too.
Yes, he's in Stagecoach as well. And, you know, we talked about It's a Wonderful Life. You know, he is in It's a Wonderful Life, too. I guess I hadn't realized how prominent Thomas Mitchell is. And here in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I don't think you have his best performance, but you have him really in a place of perfect supporting actor. He supports Saunders as a reporter. You know, they kind of give each other the scoop on what's going on. He's funny. He's interesting. I really enjoyed his performance. What did you think about it, Bob?
Yeah, I'm in the same place. And they ask him to do some sort of broad comedy as well. You know, he does play a really good drunk, if we're being honest. But what I really loved about the performance is that in a movie full of bit part characters that are just way over the top, he brings that edge of like the cynical reporter, and he plays it really, really naturalistic for most of the movie. And I really loved that they bring him on screen to kind of counterbalance Jimmy Stewart's really green, naive Jefferson Smith in a lot of those scenes. I'm thinking in particular of the scene where Jeff Smith goes around Washington just punching everybody. And then he kind of goes into that press club, and Thomas Mitchell gives him the speech about, this is what everybody thinks of you.
You thought as much about being honest as you do about being smart.
Honest? Why, we're the only ones who can afford to be honest in what we tell the voters. We don't have to be reelected like politicians.
Which is, we tell them when phonies or crackpots come here to make their laws.
If it's the truth you want, what are you doing in the Senate?
What do you know about laws or making laws or what the people need?
I don't pretend to know.
And what are you doing in the Senate?
What's he doing? Why, honorary appointments.
When the country needs men up there who know and have courage as it never did before, he's just going to decorate a chair and get himself on.
Oh, but he'll vote, sure, just like his colleague tells him to.
Yes, sir, like a Christmas tiger. He'll nod his head and vote
yes.
You're not a senator. You're an honorary stooge. You ought to be shown up.
And I think that was the first moment in the movie for me where it kind of got anchored down. And I could see the performances start to settle down a little bit. And so I love the way that they used Thomas Mitchell's performance in this movie.
While I do agree with you that that scene was very important to begin anchoring the movie, that was actually another one of my nitpicks.
Oh, that scene is terrible, dude. How do you get away with running around Washington punching people if you're a senator?
And not just that. The reality of the scene, yes. How do you just get away with punching everybody? And why don't the newspapermen go and report that? But the worst part about that for me was the fact that the way Frank Capra directed that scene made it feel like Jimmy Stewart was daydreaming about punching all these men. But once he rushes into the club, the picture kind of, you know, coalesces and clears up. And you suddenly realize, oh, wait, he's actually doing this. I hated that because I was like, oh, he's just daydreaming about punching these people like any normal human would. But then all of a sudden the director pulls a fast one on you and is like, no, he actually is punching all those people.
I think you're totally onto something with the way that Capra directs all of the montages in this movie. Like, not just that one. It's even the ones where you're supposed to feel this sense of like patriotic pride in America, where Jefferson Smith goes around Washington and looks at all the monuments. And it's not just a montage of the monuments. It's a montage of the monuments with a somewhat translucent American flag waving over them, or interspersed with shots of people's faces gazing up at Abraham Lincoln. And it's just so over the top and so on the nose. And it really contrasts with some of the really restrained stuff he's doing later in the movie when they're in the Senate hall. And it's like two different people are making this movie at times, it seems.
Yeah, and that's a big struggle for this movie, is that I don't know if he knows when to be over the top and when to be restrained. And he kind of goes too far in the direction of being over the top, I think, in a lot of ways.
All right, so Brad, before we break to drink this whiskey, I want to get through some of the cast list here. We've talked about Jimmy Stewart. His performance is phenomenal. This was really the role where Jimmy Stewart starts to get respected on a major level. He was already a big star in Hollywood, but going into the 1939 Oscars, he was pretty much the front runner. He and Clark Gable, and they ended up splitting the vote and giving it to somebody else. And people were so outraged that he did not win the Oscar for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington that a year later, the Academy gives him Best Actor for his role in the movie The Philadelphia Story. And most people feel like that was kind of a makeup award, because he was so good in this movie.
I'm pissed that he didn't win the Oscar for Best Actor. Like, how do you not give it to him?
I totally agree. This, between this and Vertigo, I don't know which performance I like better because they're so vastly different. But Jimmy Stewart is so earnest in this movie. He's so naive. He's so green. But he just wins you over because he really, truly believes in what he's talking about. And he sells it somehow.
Well, and I think what I said earlier is that one of the reasons he's able to sell it is because he's placed against this backdrop of actors who are, I would imagine, told to ham it up, you know, to be so over the top. And I really do think it accentuates the way that Jimmy Stewart is able to pause and able to hold the glance of the camera. And so I think you see his, you know, demure performance against this, you know, huge backdrop of just crazy actors. And it really does serve to show you how great of an actor that Jimmy Stewart is.
But he's definitely not alone. You know, for every person in this movie who is hamming it up, I feel like there's another supporting player that's doing really strong work. And so before we go to the break, I want to focus on two. We need to talk about the female lead of this movie, Jean Arthur. And then I also want to talk about Claude Rains as Senator Payne. So, Brad, where do you want to go first?
Let's start with Claude Rains and move on to Jean Arthur.
That's perfect. I am going to just kind of come out and say that Claude Rains is probably my favorite character actor of all time. I think every movie that he's in, I'm on board for it. You know, this is our second Claude Rains movie. We did Casablanca last year, and his character in this film couldn't be any more different from Captain Reno in Casablanca. And yet, Claude Rains, every time he's on screen, my eyes are gravitating towards him, but he's not doing anything showy. He's just so embodying this character that I think in a lot of ways he's stealing the show from Jimmy Stewart.
Bob, I 100% agree. Every time that he is on screen, he has this gravitas that just draws the camera to him. And he plays the part of the esteemed, noble senator so well that even when you find out that he's completely corrupt and has been, you know, a stooge for this newspaper magnate for all these years, there's a part of you that still believes, no, there's goodness in him. You know, it's kind of like Luke believing that Darth Vader still has goodness in him. Like, you still want to know, like, no, Claude Rains can't be fully evil. He'll come to the good side eventually.
And the way that he does it, too, he plays conflicted and he plays guilty, or like a sense of guilt and remorse so well. And he does it so subtly with just a look on his face in some of these scenes that he really emotionally draws something out of you, too. There's this great scene where Jimmy Stewart and Claude Rains are riding on the train to Washington. And we already know that Senator Payne is corrupt, but we also know that Jimmy Stewart has such a fond appreciation for him, and he's just revealed that his father was actually really good friends with Senator Payne way back in the day, and that Jimmy Stewart's dad decided to take on like some sort of corrupt political newspaper magnate or something. And Senator Payne starts talking about Jimmy Stewart's dad, talks about how he sat at that roll-top desk, and they're reminiscing together. And then they get to the reveal that Jefferson Smith's dad was murdered, and Claude Rains starts talking about how he found him slumped over his desk, and then he repeats the line, still with his hat on, still with his hat on, and he starts to look out the window, and you can see tears welling up in his eyes. And I was floored by that scene, because none of that information is really necessary to the plot of the movie. But it so perfectly adds something to that relationship between the two men that are talking. And it so perfectly adds to Senator Payne's backstory that, like, I found myself tearing up listening to this fictional conversation about a guy that's not even in the movie.
That scene really helps set the stage for the rest of the movie. That there's going to be camaraderie and fun and caring for one another, but there's going to be a depth to this movie that's going to surprise you, and it's going to grip you throughout the entire thing. And this scene really sets you up for that.
I totally agree, Brad.
Can I ask you one question, though, about Claude Rains and his character?
Sure.
Do we get an early hint at his corruption when they are at this news conference, when they are announcing, you know, Jimmy Stewart as the new senator? And he says, oh, yeah, this is my father's old friend, you know, Senator Payne. And Claude Rains looks over at Jimmy Stewart's mom, and she kind of like winks and like waves at him. Did they sleep together?
No, dude, no.
Bob, I'm pretty positive that they either slept together before the mom was married to Jimmy Stewart's dad, or something, because that was weird.
I didn't take it that way at all. I took it as he was so shocked because he wasn't expecting that. And then when Jimmy Stewart revealed, you knew my dad, he looks over at Jimmy Stewart's mom and she's there smiling and nodding this knowing smile of like, yeah, do you recognize me now? And she's like, hello. And I just took it as like this really deep connection of, wow, it's been so long since I've even thought about you. I didn't see any, I wasn't reading anything into that.
Oh man, it felt weird. And honestly, it also felt weird that he would be named to the state senate and Senator Payne would have no memory whatsoever of his best friend's son. That just felt really weird to me. Like, how would he not have kept up with that family after his best friend was shot and killed by the, you know, by a newspaper magnate or something. Like, that just felt very strange to me.
Or even that he wasn't briefed at all on who the new senator was.
Yeah, by the way, your new counterpart in Washington is going to be Jefferson Smith. He's from such and such area. Oh, I had an old friend from that area. Like, clearly, I feel like he wouldn't have found out at the news conference.
Well, Brad, I think this is a good place for us to take a break. I think we've gotten all of our nitpicks out. And I'm kind of glad we did nitpicks early. You know, we went out of order today. But for me, watching this film, the first hour and 15 minutes were really up and down and kind of uneven. And then once they get into the Senate and you first get Jefferson Smith being accused of something he didn't do, from that point on, the movie just takes off. And the last half hour or so is super suspenseful. And I cannot wait to get into talking about the back half of this movie. But before we do that, what do you say we pause and drink some bullet bourbon? All right, so Brad, today we are checking out bullet bourbon. Now, last season we did bullet rye, and it was only a matter of time until we started talking about bullet bourbon. This is one of the more popular bourbons in America. Brad, have you ever had bullet bourbon before?
Robert, I have had bullet bourbon before.
I have too. And, you know, I'm just going to kind of come out and say it. I'm a fan of bullet bourbon.
Yeah, we talked about bullet rye earlier in the year during season one. And we kind of agreed that bullet rye was one of the better values that you can get on the rye market for, you know, around $20 to $25.
For sure. Now, the bullet brand has a really interesting history. So it was started up, as we know it today, in 1987 by a guy named Tom Bullet. And he was using a recipe that he said that his grandfather or great-grandfather used to use to make whiskey. And so Tom Bullet started distilling this whiskey by sourcing it. Now, anyone who's listened to this podcast before will know that when I say that someone is sourcing their whiskey, it just means that they aren't distilling it themselves. They either don't have a distillery or they're just paying a distillery to do a custom mash bill for them. And that's what Tom Bullet was doing. He was actually paying the Ancient Age Distillery to customize a mash bill for him, but then he got the distillate and he put it in barrels and he sat on it for a number of years until it was aged to his satisfaction and then released it. So even though he wasn't making it, it wasn't like he was just buying whiskey that was already aged and putting it in bottles and releasing it. But what's super interesting about Bullet is that over the years, the contract of who is making the distillate is like it's constantly changing. So Ancient Age, eventually the contract runs out with them, and then he moves over to the Four Roses Distillery. Four Roses is making his product for a while, and then they get bought by Seagram's, and Seagram's is expanding, and then eventually Seagram sells out to Diageo. And so around 2012, 2013, we find out that Four Roses is no longer able to make Bullet Bourbon the way they have been, because Four Roses and Bullet are blowing up so much, they just don't have the ability to do it anymore. And so what we found out is that there is some unspecified distilleries out there making Bullet Bourbon for them, and we have no idea who it is. We have no idea how much of the Four Roses is left in this mix. And so what we're drinking today is this kind of really interesting mashup or mix up of a bunch of different people's stuff that's just kind of been artfully blended together to make Bullet Bourbon.
It's kind of like the Caped Crusader of bourbon.
I guess so.
Not the bourbon we want, but it's the bourbon we deserve.
Now, they have built their own distillery. They just built it in 2017, but we know that because this product is at least 6 years old, we are not getting any of that brand new bullet-made whiskey. So this is sourced from somewhere, but we can't say where.
That is a fascinating story. I'm curious to know how many of our listeners knew that, because I did not.
Yeah, it's a weird, weird history. But you know what's not weird is the way this stuff tastes. So I want to get into trying this out.
That was a beautiful transition.
Thank you, sir.
I love it.
I'm really anxious to try this, Brad. What are you picking up on the nose of this?
Oh, man. This is a classic bourbon, Bob. I am picking up some nice caramely notes, some vanilla. It's not an extremely strong nose. It's not going to overpower you, but it's really pleasant so far.
Yeah, I actually get quite a bit of those classic bourbon notes. You're right. A lot of oak, actually. But I'm also getting something that's kind of more soft, a little more delicate, maybe something floral. I definitely have some fruit notes coming off this. In the glass that I'm trying it out of, the rocks glass, I got quite a bit of like a green apple note to this as well. I don't know, Brad, are you picking up any fruit notes on this?
There's a few fruit notes kind of going on, but they're very subtle for me.
One thing I'm surprised by is that the mash bill on this, it's a high rye bourbon, meaning the second highest used grain behind corn is rye. And the approximate mash bill is 68 corn, 28 rye, and then 4% barley. So you would expect to smell quite a bit more rye spice on this, but it's actually not overpowering to me. I'm not really picking up a ton of rye on the nose.
Yeah, so what kind of a score are you going to give it, Bob?
I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the nose. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's a really interesting nose. It's decently complex. I'm going to give it an 8.
All right, why don't we go ahead and take a sip? All right, so it's really sweet on the front end, and there's a little bit of that rye spice. I don't feel like the spice goes through the whole palate. Like, by the time you go to swallow and you kick it to the back of your mouth, there's not a ton of rye spice left on it. This is only 90 proof, so it's not like it's really, really high proof. But I'm kind of surprised that there's not a little bit more punch to it. The sweetness is there all the way through, but not a ton of spice.
Yeah, I'm really curious what your thoughts are on the viscosity, though, Bob.
Well, Bradley, I actually was kind of trying to hint at that a little bit when we're talking about the lower proof. I do think it's a little thin because it's been watered down just a bit. And they do make a bourbon barrel strength. And so clearly this has been watered down. I did find it a little bit thin. Did you?
Yeah, I would say so. It was a little less viscous than I might want it to be. But, you know, I will say, in the defense of Bullet Bourbon and all the other bourbons we've talked about being watered down, all bourbon is watered down unless it is barrel strength. And let me tell you what, I don't think many people out there really want barrel strength bourbon every time they go to drink whiskey.
No.
So I don't want people to get the wrong connotation that when we say watered down, we mean poor quality.
No, I think that's a good point. So Brad, what would you give this on the taste?
I'm going to give it a 7 on the taste. I think it's really impressive. It's really sweet. But it's not overwhelming me in any great way. So I'll give it a 7.
Yeah, I'm in the same place. I'm going to give it a 7 as well, which brings us to finish. And I actually think the finish on this is a little bit better than the taste. It has some really good lasting flavor to it. I actually found when I breathed out after this, there was like a really nice note of cinnamon, almost like a candy. It was like a cinnamon red hot or something.
Mm.
And I really, really liked how the sweetness stayed on this through the finish. So I'm going to give it an 8 on the finish.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the finish. I really love the way that this kind of swirls around at the back of the mouth and it sits on the palate for a while. It has a really nice finish.
So that brings us to overall balance. Now, this is nose, taste, and finish put together. Brad, I think for the budget bourbon that this is a really well put together bourbon. Nothing really stands out more than anything else. But I was a little underwhelmed by the taste and how it wasn't really consistent all the way through. So I think I'm going to give it a 7.5 on balance.
I'm right there with you, Bob. 7.5. And for all the reasons you gave, it's a really good whiskey. It's lacking in a few areas, but overall, pretty well balanced.
Now, Bullet Bourbon is an affordable bourbon. This is, in the state of Ohio, $23.99 for a fifth of Bullet. So you're going to be set back about $24. And that might vary a bit depending on where you're listening. But overall, I think this is a really good value. Would it be the first thing I picked up at this price point? Probably not. But would I pay $24 for a fifth of this? Absolutely. So I think I'm going to give this a 7.5 on value.
Oh, I'm actually going to give it an 8.5 on value. I really think that this is one of the better bargain bourbons that you can get. You know, you don't want to break the bank for it. So you're going to spend $20 to $25, pick up a bottle of Bullet. It is a really impressive bourbon for the price that you're paying for it. Now, if this costs $30, my value score would diminish greatly because I don't think it's worth that price. But right there at the $22, $23, $24, go get this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. When I walk into someone's house and they have a bottle of Bullet, it tells me that that person really values a consistent product. I have never been disappointed by Bullet. And, you know, it's definitely a step above your Jim's, your Jack's, anything like that. And so, yeah, you're right, Brad. I think that this is something that I would highly recommend even the beginner to go try.
Oh, for sure. This is definitely going to introduce you into those mid-tier you know, quality products that you don't have to spend, you know, all of your hard-earned money on. So yeah, I would also highly recommend, you know, my final score comes out to a 38.5 out of 50.
And my final score comes out to a 37.5, which means that we're coming out to an average of a 38 or a 76 out of 100. This is a very high score. And I think that the price point really helps this bourbon a lot. This is a great bourbon for the price. Like Brad said, if this was in the $30 to $40 range, I don't think that it has quite enough complexity to justify that price tag. But at $24, it's hard to beat this one.
You know what I was just thinking about, Bob? We've been on a really good run of whiskey lately. Do you remember when I gave Basil Hayden's like a 6 out of 50?
Like, oh, do I?
Like, it's been a really long time since I feel like either of us have had to give anything a low score. And I'm kind of happy about that.
I am too. It really puts me in a good mood for talking about the movies on this podcast.
Well, speaking of movies, how about we get back to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
Let's do it. All right, so that was Bullet Bourbon, a bourbon that Brad and I really, really enjoy. And I think that it's appropriate because this is a movie that we both enjoy. But Brad, there are people out there that do not like the film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and it is time for us to introduce ourselves to those people via our segment, Hot Takes.
Hot Takes.
This is where we read one-star reviews of classic films, and I'm happy to report that on IMDb, I only see 3 user reviews that gave this movie a 1 out of 10. So it seems like most people have the right thought about this movie, except for IMDb user T. Pompa, who titles their review Abysmally Bad.
Wow.
I cannot believe that this movie is considered a classic. The situations are ridiculous to the extreme. The black hats and white hats are way, way over the top. And the Dewey sentimentality is so saccharine as to give one a sugar hangover. Stewart's performance has to rank as the worst of his career. I found it completely irrational that simply stating to the press that Senator Smith owned the property in question would cause such a furor. Didn't they have real estate records in 1939? While I love It's a Wonderful Life and try to watch it at least once a year, I cannot understand why this dreadful effort is considered one of Frank Capra's best. Don't waste your time or your money. There are far superior movies directed by Capra out there, and much, much better work by Jimmy Stewart. 1 star.
There are so many things wrong with that review. Can we just talk for a second
about the fact that this person hung their whole review on Jimmy Stewart getting accused of owning that tract of land and saying, weren't there any real estate records? When a whole part of that scene was the fact that they produced the real estate records and they had forged his signature on it?
Yeah, yeah. That seems like he just didn't actually watch all of the movie.
No. T. Pompa. More like T. Pompous, am I right?
T. Idiot. The rest of the episode should just be us saying T. Dum Dum.
I'm on board for that, actually. All right, so Brad, let's get into actually talking about good takes on this movie. And by that, I mean you and me. It struck me that we never actually got around to talking about Jean Arthur in this movie before we went to the break. And so I just want to spend a second talking about her performance as Saunders, because if I'm being 100% honest here, I love Jean Arthur. I think she is fantastic in this movie, and the way she plays the cynical DC, I don't know, what would you call her job? Clerk?
Yeah, she's like a clerk, and she, you know, she obviously knows Senator Payne pretty well because he sends her to keep an eye on him and kind of help guide him through the small things and keep him out of trouble. But yeah, she's just this clerk that grew up in Baltimore, works in DC, has never left the city in her life, and, you know, she's very cynical, and she plays that extremely well.
Yeah, but she also, you know, in cliched movie fashion, she has a heart of gold. And I found that she really finds a way to balance those extremes really well without it coming across as too eye-rolling. Because there are some lines that she's asked to deliver. You know, after Jimmy Stewart first gets accused in the Senate and he decides to kind of run away and she has to chase him and finds him at the Lincoln Memorial, she gives this impassioned speech about his ideals and why he should go back. That dialogue is really not great. And somehow she manages to make that speech really rousing and believable and emotional. And I think that she is just fantastic in this movie.
When you get home, what are you going to tell those kids?
Well, I'll tell them the truth. Might as well find it out now as later.
I don't think they'll believe you, Jeff. You know, they're liable to look up at you with hurt faces and say, Jeff, what did you do? Quit? Didn't you do something about it?
Well, what do you expect me to do? An honorary stooge like me against the tailors and pains and machines and lies.
Your friend Mr. Lincoln had his tailors and pains. So did every other man who ever tried to lift his thought up off the ground. Odds against him didn't stop those men. They were fools that way. All the good that ever came into this world came from fools with faith like that. You know that, Jeff. You can't quit now. Not you.
I was going to say, I really didn't even notice that the dialogue was that poor. I enjoyed that scene so much, and it's mostly because she was just really, really, really great in that scene. Like you said, she's impassioned, she's caring. You know, she kind of gently lifts Jimmy Stewart up and his spirits, as well as, you know, getting him to move forward. I was very impressed with her performance in this movie.
And I think, Brad, that as we start to get into the back part of this episode, I want to ask you, what was something that you think this movie did really, really well? Because we've gone through our nitpicks and we've gone through the things that we don't think Frank Capra did super well. And yet, I still come out of this movie after repeat viewings in love with it. So what did you think this movie was really effective at?
Well, I'm going to start with something that was extremely small. And it might be something that not many people thought about or picked up on. But there was one small moment between Jimmy Stewart and Gene Arthur when they've written the bill and, you know, Jimmy Stewart presented it before the Senate and they had this triumphant moment and they're back in the office afterwards and Jimmy's just going off and he's getting these letters from kids with their nickels and, you know, pennies to pay for this camp. And I love there's this small moment where he kind of like has a light bulb. And he looks over at her and he walks over and he says, Saunders, this wouldn't have gotten done without you. And he takes her hand and he shakes her hand like an equal. And I just thought, and I'm like, man, how many movies would you see in 1939 where a man treats a woman like an equal and it's not out of a desire for sex or a romantic relationship? Like at this point in the movie, I haven't picked up on any romantic overtones. And so you get this moment where he treats her as an equal and thanks her for her role in bringing this bill to light. And that moment just, I don't know, there's something about it that struck me that was extremely beautiful.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I've already touched on this, but I think what Capra does with finding ways to educate the audience about what's going on or what's going to happen on screen, you know, I've said that this last 45 minutes of this movie is actually suspenseful. And I think that that's the right word to use, because we've talked about what suspense is in the past with Alfred Hitchcock. It's when the audience knows something that the characters don't yet. And we find out just enough in those early scenes with Saunders and with Jefferson Smith how it's going to be when he introduces a bill. She explains the process of how bills go to committee and things like that. And then when Jefferson Smith goes to the Senate floor, you've got the page boy explaining where everybody's sitting. And so from a filmmaking perspective, you already know the geography of that room before anything really goes down. And so when something finally does go down, you've learned just enough about how he's going to craft his argument that when she reaches over the banister where Diz is sitting and she looks at him and says, Diz, here we go. I start leaning forward in my chair and I'm like, yep, here we go. Something's about to happen. And Capra really wisely drops all the music out, and it is just this tour de force of back and forth arguing and sparks flying in that Senate chamber. And I think Capra nails the last half of this movie.
Mr. President, I wish to ask my distinguished colleague, has he one scrap of evidence to add now to the defense he did not give and could not give at that same hearing?
I have no defense against forged papers.
Committee ruled otherwise. The gentleman stands guilty, as charged. And I believe I speak for every member when I say that no one cares to hear what a man of his condemned character has to say about any section of any legislation before this House.
Right. Order, gentlemen.
Mr. President, I stand guilty as framed because Section 40 is graft. And I was ready to say so. I was ready to tell you that a certain man in my state, a Mr. James Taylor, wanted to put through this dam for his own profit. A man who controls a political machine and controls everything else worth controlling in my state. Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen. And I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
Senator, yield.
No, sir, I will not yield.
Honestly, what that last half really reminded me of was To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, when we reviewed that movie, we talked about how, you know, a lot of the movie has flaws and issues and problems, but that scene in the courthouse is literally like an 11 out of 10 perfect movie. And I think you could probably say the exact same thing about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think I might even venture to say that the last half of this movie is even more effective than that courtroom scene in To Kill a Mockingbird. Because one of my gripes with To Kill a Mockingbird is, as great as Gregory Peck is in that movie, Atticus Finch is not a very impassioned man. He's very stoic and measured and calm and cool and collected in the face of hatred around him. But what this movie has going for it is that Jefferson Smith, from the very beginning, is so passionate about everything he does that when it comes time to defend himself, Jimmy Stewart is up there yelling and waving his arms, and you're with him the whole way. And I think he's matching the intensity level of everyone around him. And that's what makes that scene and that sequence even more compelling to me to watch than that courtroom sequence in To Kill a Mockingbird.
And I think another thing that's amazing about that scene is that you don't feel like the other senators are evil for the stances that they take. You know, they show you that committee hearing where they're trying to decide if Jimmy Stewart should be expelled from the Senate, and you see all the evidence mount up against him. You know, kind of like that early opening scene in the movie, Capper just hammers you with point after point of Jimmy Stewart's, you know, wrongdoing. And so when you see all of that evidence, I don't know about you, Bob, but I didn't feel any anger or enmity towards the other senators who are dismissing him. You know, you have Senator Payne on the one side, who is a respected, distinguished member of the Senate, who is on the verge of a presidential, you know, run. And so you kind of understand where they're coming from. Like, who do you think you are, this young upstart who's trying to make money off of us, this dignified body, and you know, run off with a bunch of cash?
And you talked about this earlier, but they do the same thing with Payne, where even though he is the adversary to Jimmy Stewart in that room, he's still not a person that you think is totally gone. And they do such a good job of showing how conflicted he is throughout the film. And I think what you're really understanding as they argue with each other on that Senate floor is that in a lot of ways, this movie is as much about Joe Payne's conscience as it is about Jeff Smith's conscience. He's fighting for what he believes in. And at the same time, Joseph Payne is fighting to kind of keep himself from selling his soul. And I love that they juxtapose those two things against each other throughout the movie, because at the end of the film, it's actually kind of a sucker punch. You find out that, like, Taylor's machine wins. All of the telegrams that are coming in from Jimmy Stewart's state say Jeff Smith needs to stop his filibuster and step down.
I guess this is just another lost cause, Mr. Payne. All you people don't know about lost causes. Mr. Payne does. He said once they were the only causes worth fighting for. And he fought for them once. For the only reason any man ever fights for them. Because of just one plain, simple rule. Love thy neighbor. And in this world today, full of hatred, a man who knows that one rule has a great trust. You know that rule, Mr. Payne. And I loved you for it just as my father did. And you know that you fight for the lost causes harder than for any others. Yes, you even die for them. Like a man we both know, Mr. Payne.
But for all Jeff Smith knows, he's lost. He actually faints because he's so exhausted from arguing. And the sight of them carrying out this man unconscious helpless is what finally gets to Joseph Payne's conscience. And if it wasn't for him at the end of the movie finally admitting what he did, this movie would end with Jefferson Smith losing the battle for goodness. It's a really interesting way to end the film.
Yeah, it's an amazing way to end the film. And I thought it was really fascinating to see all of the Christ references that Capra gives Jimmy Stewart throughout the movie. And, you know, he caps them all off with them carrying him out like he had just died on the crucifix. You know what I mean? And I just, once again, it was over the top and kind of obvious, but I thought it was effective.
Yeah, it's super effective. And that's part of my struggle with this movie is that everything this movie does wrong, it still kind of does right because it all works. It is, in some parts, like a propaganda movie. And you're kind of aware of it as Jimmy Stewart's walking around Washington. This movie is like falling all over itself to praise the American experiment, right? But even then, even as I know that that's what they're doing, it still works somehow. And I'm still on board for it.
Yeah, I like that you use the word propaganda because I guess I hadn't really put it in my head yet. But you're right. This movie has such an obvious message that it's trying to get across. It doesn't ever try to hide it in the same way that propaganda doesn't try to hide what it is a lot of times. And so you get this message that comes across, but the performances by Stewart and Arthur and Rains are just so compelling and interesting that I don't even care. I love every moment of it.
And the funny thing is that when this movie came out, it actually was denounced in the U.S. Senate in real life, and they argued that it belittled the American system of government. And Joseph Kennedy, U.S. ambassador to England at the time, he actually sent a telegraph to President Roosevelt and to the State Department and then to the head of the movie studio, Columbia, and said that they need to stop showing this movie overseas because, quote, it will cause our allies to view us in an unfavorable light. They were so concerned about the image of political corruption getting out that they kind of missed the whole point that someone who really digs his heels in and stands up for good can win in the end. I think it's just really fascinating that they tried to kill this movie in a way.
I guess, honestly, though, it makes sense to me because in so many ways, movie presents reality with, you know, tinted glasses that, I mean, just by a plain watching of that movie, you might think that half of the senators there are on the take by some powerful businessman from their state. You know, it would be slightly unbelievable to think that Joseph Payne is the only senator who was empowered by a powerful businessman and is beholden to him. So I guess it does kind of make sense to me that the Senate would get annoyed that they presented, you know, the highest body of legislation in the world as largely corrupt. One of the things about this movie that made me so profoundly sad, and it's because I've had so many conversations in the last few months, the last few years with friends and family and people I meet at the coffee shop I work at and so many people about politics that I watch this movie and I just feel like I see the weaponization of politics to shame others. So many people in this country find their identity in politics that they innately just think that if somebody else identifies differently than them politically, then they are evil because that forms the core of who they are. And I finished watching this movie and I was just sad and troubled. And I don't know what to do with it, you know, because this movie portrays such a triumphant picture of the common man triumphing over the evils of big business and the evils of a corrupt government. But here we are 80 years later, and I don't feel like we've advanced away from that. And I'm just being very raw with the Film and Whiskey Nation right now, but this film really made me struggle. I'm not doing well after this film.
Brad, I think what you're getting at is that you really do have a choice when you watch this movie of how you're going to respond to it. And I think this kind of mirrors my own experience with the movie. This movie can be a piece of pro-America propaganda. It can sweep things under the rug, and it doesn't really take a hard look at some of the deeper issues of what's going on in America. And I think that you can come away from this movie kind of just dismissing it and joking about how cheesy it is and how pro-America it is, or you can see what they're trying to do with the movie. You can see that they are addressing issues of corruption, issues of greed and big business. And I think at the end of the day, what this movie comes down on is, no, this thing that we call America can really work and it really can be beautiful. And I think for people in America today who are so turned off by what's going on politically and who are so skeptical of where our country is going, I think that this movie can really serve as a beautiful reminder of what we can be if we really stick to our principles and we dig in our heels and we refuse to back down like Jefferson Smith. And so I walk away from this movie inspired instead of cynical.
What makes me sad is to see the common American human being just spew such vitriolic acid on one another. You know, their fellow citizens, their fellow human beings. It's really hard for me to see how politicized America has become.
And I think that's what I'm trying to say, Brad, is we each have a choice to make as individuals in this nation. And I choose to watch a movie like this and let this movie inspire me to do better. Because you're right, we can take it and we can turn it into something ugly, or we can recognize the ugliness that's within all of us and within the system, and we can still choose not to look away, not to give into it like Senator Payne, but to face it head on. And I think that's what this movie inspires me to do.
Well, not only do we have the opportunity day by day to choose the good, but you and I, Bob, right now have the opportunity to give this movie a score. So as we come to the end of this podcast, I can't get away from giving this movie a 10 out of 10. We kind of talked about this with To Kill a Mockingbird, that, you know, with all of the flaws of the first two-thirds of this movie, can they be overcome by the beauty of that last third? And I'm going to say yes. I think that the message of this movie that we just kind of touched on, as well as how beautiful the performances are by, you know, Jimmy Stewart and Jean Arthur and Claude Rains, I just think this is a fantastic piece of cinema, and I can't not give it a 10 out of 10.
This movie has always been a 10 out of 10 for me on IMDb, and I sit down to watch it last night, and I had to fight off the critic in my mind, because if I was being totally objective, if I never seen this film before, I have a feeling I would only give this movie a 9 out of 10. There are just too many instances where Capra as a director goes over the top or is too on the nose. I actually think the very end of this film is a little rushed, and it seems really abrupt that it just fades out and says the end. And I think that I can no longer give it a 10 out of 10, but I'm also not going to be the guy that drops it all the way to a 9. I love this movie. I love what it has to say. I love what it does for me and the emotional ride it takes me on. So I'm going to give this movie a 9.5. And that brings our final total out to a 9.75, or a 97.5 out of 100.
Yeah, this movie is spectacular. And honestly, there are a lot of issues with it. And I came out of the movie waffling between a 9.5 and a 10. Because I do think if I was giving into my more critical side, I would give this movie a 9.5. There's a lot of big issues with it, but they are overcome by the beauty of it. But I just can't get over the message that this movie gives us about our opportunity to choose the good day in and day out, just like Jefferson Smith. And that message is going to push me over the top. And I do give this a guaranteed 10 out of 10. Highly recommend to any human being who hasn't seen this film.
But we want to know what you think. So please get on social media. Let us know your reaction to this movie. You can find us on Twitter, on Instagram, or on Facebook at
Film Whiskey.
That's Film Whiskey with an E, or you can give us a call on our call-in line. Please leave us a voicemail. We'll play it on air. Brad, what's the number?
216-800-5923. Once again, that number is 216-800-5923.
We will be back next week continuing our 1939 series with John Ford's Western masterpiece, Stagecoach. For the Film and Whiskey Podcast, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
We'll see you next time.